Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. And it is truly a miraculous day because despite being in stage 5 load shedding, all of us on the show today have electricity, which presumably means that most of our audience doesn't, because if we're on, that means that all of you guys must be off. But anyway, we hope that you still are able to hear us at some point, even if you're watching us after we've been live. I am, of course, your host, Nicholas Lorimer. I'm joined today by Sarah Gon. Sarah, how are you doing?
Well, thank you. I'm very sorry that the 90% chance of rain didn't materialize. Everything needs a wash.
Yeah, I must say I'm a bit over spring sometimes until the rain comes. But then I don't like the outdoors in general. And, of course, we're also joined by Mr. Maurice Ritt. Maurice, how are you doing?
How's it, guys? Looks like it's clouding over here, so I think maybe it will rain soon.
Indeed. And first, I just want to give a quick word from our sponsor. So this week we are sponsored by Trendy Trees. Trendy Trees is the leading luxury Christmas specialist. Buy a Christmas tree and enjoy it in your home or office for years to come. Or hire a Christmas tree and Trendy Trees will deliver, assemble, and decorate it for you. Visit trendytrees.co.za, your Christmas decoration specialists located in Cape Town, Johannesburg, and Plettenberg Bay. And thanks very much to them for sponsoring us. It's very good to be sponsored by some Christmas cheer, because, of course, Christmas is fast approaching, the best time of the year in South Africa. All right, let us get into our first news story for today. And this is, I don't think there's too much to say about this, but it's still worth maybe going over again. And this is the curious case of the rogue Cope councillor. So the fate of the city of Johannesburg appears to be, in many ways at the moment, being determined by a single councillor from the Congress of the People Party, Colleen Makabule, who defected from the coalition, the anti-ANC coalition, to side with the ANC coalition, voting out the DA Speaker of the City of Johannesburg. She then declared herself the acting Speaker of the Council, which is against the rules, and was found so by a court. And it seems that the national leadership of COPE have suspended her, saying that she has violated the party's directives, that she is not acting in accordance with the will of the voters of Johannesburg, and she's now suspended as a member of COPE and from her seat. However, it appears that the Joburg region of COPE disagrees and say that this is not a correct structure, that Dennis Bloom, who was the COPE leader who said that she's suspended, is not correct, and that she's in fact not suspended, which is a bit of a mess. And I believe the Joburg coalition can probably hold together without the COPE vote, as long as everyone else stays on board. I know that the IFP and the ACDP have already begun disciplining their councillors for voting with the ANC in that vote of no confidence. But it's all a little bit of a mess still. Sarah, what's your takeaway from this?
Well, as we were chatting about it, the problem with COPE is that it's small and it's weak, and it's weak centrally. So as you said, you know, if Ms. Makabule is prepared to sort of run COPE in Joburg or Gauteng, that's quite a powerful place to do it. And then you can, I guess, feel emboldened to not only go against the coalition to which you agreed to be part of, but also to kind of walk up to the speaker's chair and sit down in it and say, I'm it. I was a bit surprised when I saw that, because I kind of thought, I'm sure being a city council, there have to be all sorts of rules involved in this. But it is concerned that there has been tensions at the top. There's been some actually quite impressive scenes of aggression taking place after one media conference.
And our pre-show talk, Morris described it as two men fighting over a comb, bald men fighting over a comb.
But you see, the problem is that in this day and age, you know, anyone who's earning a salary from government is in a stronger position than the next guy, and I think that's probably what it's all about. I kind of feel sorry for Terry Lakota, because I think he's a principled guy. I know from experience many years ago he's a good guy. I was involved with law firm in getting him out of jail when he was held by the security services. But, you know, as we've seen with political parties coming and going in the last few years, the strength of leadership is crucial. And once he, and the, after the, I think they initially got 9% when they broke away from the ANC in the national poll.
7%.
Which is impressive. I mean, you're looking at a couple of months between events. Cope has just disintegrated into a two-man and then a one-man show, essentially. So there's, as you say, it's not fighting over much, but what there is valuable to whoever gets it.
Right. It's quite interesting because ever since we talked about this fight between the sort of, I guess, the Dennis Blum faction and the Lakota faction of Cope, Lakota seems to have sort of disappeared from the news, and I'm not sure if that's just because he's not doing media well or whether it's because he really has lost the battle for control of Cope. But I think the larger issue here is the problem of what happens when parties don't have very strong chains of accountability or party structures that are able to actually enforce the way things are going. You know, we vote for parties in South Africa. That's how our system works. I know a lot of people are unhappy with that, but for that system to kind of work, you at least have to be able to say that there's a link between the party that you voted for and the people who got into office. In this case, Marius, it kind of seems like if the party can't discipline someone who is not doing what they tell them to do, then there really isn't a chain of accountability here. They're just kind of rogue. What do you make of this, Marius?
Yeah, and then we've seen what's happened. I mean, it's basically making Cope fall apart. But also, I mean, as you mentioned, Cope wasn't the only party which had councillors go rogue. I think two ACDP councillors and an IFP councillor also voted against the or voted for Vasco da Gama to be unseated. So, but yeah, it's all quite an edifying spectacle, and it's all pretty sad, actually. I mean, Cope was kind of the great political hope for South Africa when he emerged in end of 2008. And as Sarah mentioned, did pretty well in his first election, got nearly 8% of the votes, actually. I think better than EFF in his first election, and got MPLs in each of the provincial legislatures, and nearly got 20% of the votes in Northern Cape, about 14% in the Eastern Cape. And you've looked just 10 years later, it's only got two MPs and not any MPLs, I don't think. So, yeah, and I think, but that's also something to, it's also actually a warning for coalitions in general, because when Cope came to the fore, it was launched as, you know, as kind of a constitutionalist party, you know, kind of, you know, pro-free markets and so on, non-racialism. But if you dug a bit deeper, you could see it was actually the main reason people got together was because it was an anti-Zuma front. You know, you had people like Masuya Lokoto who were kind of Mbekiarts. You had trade unionists and like hard leftists, like people like Philip Dexter and other unionists like William Adisha and Bazima Shaloa. You had like business people like Deirdre Carter and so on. So, you know, there was no real actual ideological thread holding Cope together. And I think that's what we've seen has happened to the party. It's kind of a microcosm of what could happen to coalitions. And I mean, I suppose what's been happening in Joburg is also a warning for what could happen to coalitions as coalitions become more common in South Africa. And we are going to be governed by a coalition either after 2024 or definitely after 2029.
I think that's actually a really good point, Morris, because, you know, often a lot of people, especially those who aren't really like politics nerds or into politics, say, What is this ideology thing? What is the point of an ideology? You know, we must just do what works. We must be pragmatic, that kind of thing. And I mean, firstly, you know, what works, I think, is arguable. It's not always necessarily clear, and ideology helps you to steer through those waters. But secondly, having a shared idea of what you actually sort of want your society to look like, what are the values that you hold to be important, what are the policies that are most important to you, and which ones can you compromise on? This is what ideology is. And when you don't have it, you know, maybe the ordinary voter doesn't necessarily say, you know, I want a liberal, I want a communist, I want a whatever. But the effects of not having the ideology, I think, can be seen, as you say, in Cope. When you don't have a string to hold you together, when you're not all even vaguely, never mind being on the same page, in the same book, things can go very haywire very quickly. Sarah, final thoughts on this topic?
Yeah, two things. One is that essentially, just to add to that, your ideology just is essentially the string in the middle of the whole construct. So yes, that's exactly, political parties are there to be practical and to do things that benefit people. But when there are disputes and there are debates and things threaten to fall apart, the consistency of that thread is what will hold a party together or not, as the case may be. The other thing is, I hope we'll find out from the ACDP and the IFP, why their people voted against their wishes at this, in this coalition regarding the speaker. That I'm really curious about. In other words, did they have suddenly an ideological change of heart, or did money come into play? Or is this, or that the one the same as the other?
Right, and the DA specifically has said that one of their councillors was offered 2 million rand to switch votes. So yeah, that's going to end up in court, no doubt, and we'll see what comes of that. So let's move on to our next topic. And here I think we're tying two news stories together to talk a little bit about devolution of powers. So the Western Cape government has issued statements complaining they're very upset that the train services in Malmesbury have been withdrawn by PRASA, that's the Passenger Rail South Africa agency. According to PRASA, the withdrawal is due to problems that they have with the service provider that supplies diesel for the Malmesbury diesel train service. The Western Cape government said that this was really cutting off commuters from opportunities in the area, and that it was going to make people's lives a lot harder and transport more expensive. So that's one sort of negative effect there, where we see that the provinces are held kind of a little bit, you know, that they have powers, but only so far, right? That a national government agency can just decide to change the way that things are done. And at the same time, the DA has been going on this thing of asking for increased police powers in the Western Cape, because it says that in order to combat crime effectively, it needs for national government to devolve more police powers to the provinces. There was a question asked by DA leader John Steenhuisen about this to President Cyril Ramaphosa, asking for policing powers to be transferred to the provinces, specifically the Western Cape. And it was rejected by Ramaphosa, who said that creating a parallel provincial policing structure would violate the constitution, which says that there must be a single police force. Maurice, what do you make of all this? It seems as though the fight for, the federal powers of provinces is heating up. It's, I think, more in our political conversation these days, but also so far not a huge number of successes.
Well, look, it's also quite rich that the president says that it's not the constitution doesn't allow it, so that's it, when his party is actually trying to change the actual Bill of Rights and, you know, weaken property rights protections and so on. And the thing is, in the constitution, the president is correct. It does say that there's only one national police service for South Africa. But as with a lot of things that happened during transitions, actually they came out of a bit of compromise. And while it was says there's only one national police service, things like municipal police services were allowed. So that's why we have things obviously like JMPD, Tshwane Metro Police, you know, Ekurhuleni, where I stay, Cape Town, etc. eThekwini also has a metropolitan police service. So there has actually been some devolution of policing powers. Metro police departments don't have, they're limited in what they can do. They can't investigate crimes and so on. You know, it's basically in, you know, bylaws and working with SAPS on certain things. But at the same time, I'm open to correction, but the constitution does allow for the Minister of Police to allow the NEC responsible for policing in a province to get oversight or get more, control over the police. It'll still be the SAPS, but they will be, have more oversight and control over the SAPS in their province. And I know the DA has been looking at this, and they believe without having to change the constitution, you could get more of the Western Cape government had more control over the SAPS in the Western Cape. And I think we're probably going to start seeing a lot of these kind of fights, especially after 2024, where even if we don't govern in coalition nationally, Gauteng is probably going to be governed in coalition. KwaZulu-Natal is probably going to be governed in coalition. The Western Cape is probably still going to be a DA province. And it's not impossible that we'll see places like the Northern Cape, even the Free State or Northwest governing coalition, you know, anti-ANC coalitions after 2024. So I think we're going to start seeing these fights happening more and more often. You know, it's quite likely that we might have a DA-led coalition in Gauteng that will, it'll be all the metros in Gauteng will be DA-led coalitions, and then the provincial governments, you know, so it's kind of, yeah, things are going to get quite interesting in the Chinese sense of the word after 2024. But yeah, I mean, President Ramaphosa's saying that you can't allow provincial police. It's, you know, it just shows the ANC's controlling instinct. And I think South Africa missed the trick, not even in 1994, but even in 1910 when South Africa first became a union, where we weren't really a federation. It was also kind of this quasi-federalism.
And whereas the other Dominions at the time, you know, Canada and Australia especially, went for the federal system. South Africa decided not to. And arguably, we're a much more diverse country than other Canada and Australia, even if we just looked at the people who basically had full political rights, which was white South Africa at the time. Even, you know, we are quite more diverse, definitely than the Australians, for example. And yeah, it's just, you know, I think South Africa, country of our size, you know, speaking geographically, population-wise, I think federalism would probably make more sense for South Africa, but, you know, while the ANC is in charge, we're not going to see any move towards that. It's got a, you know, it's a real controlling instinct that the ANC has, and I think that goes back to the influence of the Soviet Union and so on, back if we go back into the 1940s and 50s.
I wonder, though, whether that will change after, as you say, 2024, because even if the ANC and EFF or the ANC by itself manage to maintain a majority of parliament, like you say, they may lose control of these provinces. And I can see the ANC or any of these, or the coalition or the anti-ANC coalition kind of thinking to themselves, you know, maybe like national parliament is going to be deadlocked all the time. I mean, even with its majority now, the ANC often actually fails to get quorum in parliament for passing certain bills or things like that, because some of their members disagree with the law, so they just don't show up. And then the ANC isn't able to vote it through, even though they do have the numbers. I wonder whether every political party might begin to see some advantages in empowering the provinces to have a little bit more say, because I can see the ANC thinking, okay, well, maybe we're going to lose at national government, but we can retreat to Mpumalanga and Limpopo and Northwest and build them into fortresses of ANC-ness. And if we have more power, that would be good for us. Sarah, what do you make of that idea? What do you make of this issue?
I think the just throw an idea out more than based on any knowledge, but I think there are two inclinations towards refusing the devolution of power. The one is that there's probably that sort of nasty element that just says we are not going to give you the power. We are not going to make it easy for you to make things better, and that would apply with policing or trains or anything else. And I think the other thing is that it just the moment you devolve power, there is an admission that you are failing, that the provinces that want the power devolved either are doing a better job or are intend to try and hopefully do a better job because they've got more control over the situation. No guarantees, but that might be the situation. So I don't think the Constitution has anything to do with the price of eggs. It's also like, I mean, if you want to take the sort of jaded view of the problem with the provision of diesel to the Malmesbury trains, you know, do you attribute that to incompetence? Do you attribute that to something just unfortunate outside of your control? Or do you attribute that to corruption? Would the DA have had the same problem with providing the diesel to the trains in Malmesbury? So I think if the politics is as split as that, and the ANC loses that amount of control, I think the pressure will rise, because politicians are likely to have support from their constituents to ask for more powers to achieve things that are not being, to help achieve things that are just failing completely and utterly. But as I say, I think for Ramaphosa, I suspect he just sees it as a sign of weakness and failure, and his control is to say no, not going to do it. But as I say, ANC gets weaker, I think that'll become more difficult to do.
Mm-hmm. All right, let us move overseas. I think to our next topic. There's a bunch of interesting things going on around the world. Let's start with the Islamic Republic of Iran, as it is officially called, which has had quite a lot of internal turmoil over the past couple of years, a lot of anti-government protests. Iran is a country where, although people do get to vote for who the president is, the supreme leader of the country, who is a member of the clergy, the Islamic priesthood there, and his council of imams basically decide who is allowed to stand for president. So, as you can imagine, only people who sort of agree with the regime are allowed to actually stand as candidates. But there, so there have been major protests over the past couple of years. These keep getting sort of put down, but the latest one to break out seems pretty intense, and it really cuts to the heart of the Iranian regime. So in the Kurdish region of Iran, which is in the west, there were major protests on Monday, and security forces, according to some reports, opened fire on the protests and killed up to maybe 5 people, although it's difficult to tell because a lot of this is disputed and there isn't much independent journalism on the ground there. It's been 3 days now since the death of a woman called Mahsa Amini, who was a 22-year-old woman who was arrested by the Iranian morality police for incorrectly wearing a hijab. In Iran, all women are required by law to wear a hijab. The morality police said she wasn't wearing one that complied with the law and arrested her. She then, at some point in her captivity, went into a coma and shortly thereafter died. The police say that she just got sick and died, but her parents allege that the police beat her to death in prison. And this has sparked a huge amount of outrage across a lot of Iran, where particularly people in the towns who are already not huge fans of the government are very fed up with the morality police there. So recently on Twitter in Iran, the Persian hashtag of Mahsa Amini reached nearly 2 million Twitter mentions as it was on. It was sort of a big topic on fire everywhere. The internet was shut down in regions where rioting occurred. The Iranian regime has done this quite a few times to prevent protesters organizing. But it remains to be seen how this goes on from here. Some of the videos that have emerged show people throwing rocks at riot police, shouting death to the dictator. Sarah, what do you make of all this?
Well, let me put this. I'm not a great fan of the Islamic Republic of Iran. It's being despotic in every sense of the word. And you, with that sort of despotism and Islamism as the base of the form of governance, it's going to be strict. It's strict. It's uncompromising, and I think one could probably say it's misogynistic. I mean, you know, when somebody to say, well, you know, it's not that she wasn't wearing a hijab; it's just that she wasn't wearing it correctly or properly or whatever. The bottom line is the fact that the society is still run on the basis that men, specifically designated police, can designate what a woman should or shouldn't be wearing, particularly with respect to, you know, the traditional Muslim dress. I think it would go down less and less in the broader Muslim world, but I mean, to the Western world, it's absolutely horrifying. I mean, you know, surely one would have thought it might be the thing that would warrant a sort of strong finger wagging and a fine or something, but to actually arrest someone amongst millions of women, throw them into jail, and I'm not prepared to say categorically, but I have very little doubt that they beat her to death. You know, and given the riots that had happened, and you know, men have been killed in the process, it wasn't a sort of women's only event, is a suggestion that however autocratic the regime may be, it continues to face, and possibly now increasing opposition. I mean, one doesn't know whether this may be a tipping point. Once thought that before with Iran, and they're probably fairly buoyed up by the fact that there's actually no agreement with the U.S. currently about the development of nuclear weapons, because they've, you know, really solidified relations with Russia and China. But I think one mustn't forget that sort of sense of sort of, shall I say, toxic masculine governance, there are huge fault lines in Iran, and maybe this will hasten it on.
Yeah, it does remain to be seen. The Iranian regime has been pretty resilient, and I think part of that is based on the fact that it's able to fund itself with oil even when the internal economy is collapsing a bit. But yeah, you know, events like this do have the ability to shake politics in fundamental ways, so we'll see what happens. Marius, you've been watching the presidential election in Brazil quite closely. where we're sort of having a bit of a repeat, I believe, of one of the last elections. So the President Lula, the left-wing candidate, is going up against the right-wing candidate Bolsonaro. A couple of others. I think there's two rounds in the Brazilian presidential election votes. Lula relatively recently emerged from prison after he was sent there for corruption, and yet he is leading in the polls by a lot. In fact, it looks currently, if the polls are correct, that he's going to beat Bolsonaro by something like 10 percentage points. What do you make of what's going on in Brazil?
Yeah, so Lula is also quite a popular leader in Brazil. He was president from, I think, 2003 to 2010. While he was president, the middle class grew quite rapidly. The economy grew quite quickly as well. He also helped to lift a lot of people out of poverty. But as I was saying before the show, a lot of it was funded by debt and so on. And people who took over after him, Dilma Rousseff and so on, they weren't as good as Lula. And as you said, Lula also went to prison for corruption. He was released, if I recall correctly, on a technicality, actually. So, but yeah, he's still pretty popular in Brazil. And while he was president, he was often called the most popular politician in the world. Just he had very high approval ratings in Brazil at the time. And if he could have run for a third term, he would have been able to, he would have easily won. The reason why I can run for a third term now is you can't be president for three consecutive terms in Brazil. So this is obviously a third non-consecutive term. So that's why he's able to run now. But yeah, he's looks like he's doing pretty well. In Brazil, they have a first round. If nobody gets more than 50%, then the top two candidates go through to the second round, which looks like it's most probably going to be Lula and Bolsonaro. And the election is next month, the 2nd of October, I think. But as it stands now, in a head-to-head with polling, between Bolsonaro and Lula. Lula's probably going to beat Bolsonaro by around about 15 percentage points. But yeah, but a lot can still happen between now and then. You know, maybe Lula, we've seen polling as around the world has proven to be, pretty wonky oftentimes. So we're going to see, we'll have to wait and see what happens. But as it stands, looks like Lula's probably going to have one of the greatest comebacks since Lazarus. So it'll be interesting to see what he did when he did become president. People were a bit worried. He came from a trade union background. He was quite left-wing. He was a candidate of the Workers' Party, which was also kind of, had some communist elements and so on. But when he did govern, he was actually quite a pragmatist. You know, he didn't do anything too radical. He appointed people to his cabinet who were pretty middle-of-the-road centrists and so on. So maybe we'll see that happen again. And, I don't know. Obviously, he governed fairly well when he was president. That's obviously what Brazilians are looking towards again. And it's just quite interesting that he's making a comeback like this.
Yeah, I think it's pretty amazing, actually, to come back from that. I never really understand why in so many countries people are so... I find it surprising that you often do find people remaining politically relevant even after going to jail or being found guilty or something. I suppose his supporters believe that he's unfairly maligned. But I also suspect that there's a little bit of a case of... maybe people unhappy with Bolsonaro are just kind of looking for someone who they think will be able to defeat Bolsonaro in an election. Sara, any thoughts on this that you'd like to add?
I was actually going to say the same thing. I think the reality is that the Brazilians have had Bolsonaro, who's the sort of on the opposite side in the right wing camp, for enough years now to have not seen much great come out of his office. And he's a bit of a creep, to be quite honest. I mean, Lula is sort of liked, he actually he's liked as a person. The ANC, he loved him here. He's really liked. Well, Bolsonaro, I don't think I'd want to shake his hand, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I wonder how much of that is playing a role. I know that, look, I'm a little bit more sympathetic for Bolsonaro in that I think that a lot of people are upset with him now, possibly because, I think Lula was overrated in that he spent a lot of money and made a lot of popular decisions at the time. Mario says that he did have some genuine successes as well, but that subsequent administrations have kind of had to pick up the pieces of Lula's sugar high politics. But maybe I'm being unfair. I'm not an expert on Brazilian politics.
Well, as we said, I mean, we at Zuma, yeah, we also spent a lot of money, just like Lula did. But we don't have anything to show for the, Zuma presidency. Where at least while Lula was president, the place was growing at 4 or 5% a year. A lot of people lived out of poverty there. In South Africa, we saw the economy go backwards and, you know, a lot of people fall back into poverty. So even if you're spending money, at least you're getting something out of it, which we didn't have under the Zuma years. So.
Right. No, it's incredible. We had we spent money like we were about to have a sugar high, but then just didn't have the sugar high. Indeed, indeed. All right. So that's all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting. We will be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend Show. Check out our sponsor, Trendy Trees, and we'll see you all soon. Cheers, everyone.